This is a 3CR podcast.
And this is Published or Not.
And Jan, a good morning to you.
Do you realise writing a book is not an Olympic sport?
No, but poetry is. I was listening to a podcast about the Poetry Olympics.
Oh,
so
wow.
Writing should be, because it takes a lot longer than a 10-second race.
My book today is very timely. The Olympics are mentioned, but it's back in 1924. When the sports people were amateurs and had to pay to get to the games. This is only one small part of the Lost Letters of Rose Carey by Julie Bennett. Welcome, Julie.
Thank you so much.
I know this is your second book, but you're
yes,
a Sydney writer, so it's lovely to have you in the community of writers and 3CR down here.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, we better find out who Rose Carey is.
So Rose is a very famous film star in the 1920s, and she's come down under because she's actually Australian. She's a Hollywood movie star, but she's Australian, and she's come down under because she's made this fabulous film in New Zealand, underwater, you know, feats underwater, and she thinks that she's going to keep her career alive because she's turned that terrible age of 30-something, which is considered old in Hollywood in those days.
Well, she also had to leave America because of the scandalous affair.
Yes, indeed.
No,
yes,
she was not the victim of a liar, but being a harlot and a homewrecker.
That's right.
So she's come down with her own filming company, and there's the manager of this is Walter. Now, he's had a crew of 200 and so many more extras working on the Sea Princess of the South Pacific in New Zealand. It's finished now and they're living in Sydney, but we better talk about the other people apart from Walter, who's the manager, that are part of this company.
Sure.
Belle.
So Belle has been with Rose for a number of years and she's become indispensable. She is a wonderful support for Rose. And she's also a seamstress, so she's created some wonderful costumes for Rose throughout her career. She's also been a whiz with the business books because she was what we would call a secretary back in London, back in the day. So she's become Rose's right-hand woman and, most of all, her best friend.
And there's Eddie Quinn.
Yes, Eddie Quinn. He's a cinematographer, a cameraman, and he was in the war, Great War, and he seems to be carrying some sort of burden around. But he's a genius with the camera, so he's part of this sort of inner sanctum that's put together this movie.
And there's Alec. He was a handsome hunk.
Oh, he was a handsome hunk.
What was his job?
So Alec was an Olympian, and he's been a swimmer and a diver, and he's been a fabulous friend of Rose's since childhood. And he's helping her, coaching her to become better and better at diving, because that's how she sees her future, that she'll be making these aquatic movies.
So they're in Sydney, they're doing an exhibition dive to help promote this. So what does the exhibition dive comprise?
So what they're trying to do is build Rose's skills in diving so that they can have more of, you know, live performance-based company as well as the films. And what Alec is doing is training Rose to dive into these, what they were called in those days was crystal tanks. So these were a real thing. You know, they were great big huge glass tanks full of millions of gallons of water. And Alec is trying to train Rose into performing amazing feats so that she can take what she calls an extravaganza around the world.
Rose also wants to follow through on her plans for the Olympic athletes. Now, what are they?
So this is set in 1923. The Olympic Games in Paris are in 1924. So Rose sees herself as a sort of benefactor. She wants to encourage people to go to the Olympic Games. And of course, as you said in the intro, these were amateurs and they had to raise money. So Rose thinks a marvellous idea would be to create, to assist in an Olympic ball. It wasn't actually her idea, but she wants to make a fantastic set, water aquatic-based set for the Olympic ball.
Into this flies J.J. Griffin, another handsome hunk, and we're going to hear what Rose thinks all about this from page 107.
So this is about Rose and her diving, actually.
Yes.
So this is where she's actually practicing with Alec. So she says, "I have never been faint-hearted. The very opposite, in fact. Throughout my career, I have been thrown into a crocodile-infested pool. I have ridden horses and walked tightropes, and I have always done my own stunts. I was never doubled for a single scene in any of my films. Even before learning to high dive with Alec, I had no fear of heights. But this is a different kettle of fish altogether."
This had to do with J.J. Griffin going up in that aeroplane.
Well, you know, J.J. Griffin, he's an interesting character. Mm. He's an American. He's dashingly handsome. And he takes Rose and Belle up in his plane, which is not of the type or standard we have today, of course, sort of pioneer aviation planes. And she sees the world from a plane, and she marvels at, you know, what's opening up before her.
And she also realises that he is a manager of a competing theatrical company.
Yes.
Who's also interested in helping with the fundraising ball.
Yes, indeed.
Well, she knows that she's got props stored that she's going to use in this fundraising ball. But when she goes there,
they've disappeared. So the complicating thing here for Rose is that her manager, Walter, tells her that their company is in financial difficulty. They are in financial difficulty. So Walter, her manager, has been also a mainstay in her life. He's been with her throughout her career, and he understands that she is the cog around which their world spins.
But she's also prone to accidents.
She is.
Now, this is a quote. "Is someone really trying to ruin us, or are we being a little paranoid because we've had such a terrible run of things?" So there was something that happened in New Zealand.
There was what I call the incident.
The incident.
There was a bit of an incident in New Zealand.
So Rose thinks that a respectable marriage may help the company. And around this time, the Blue Mountains were known as a honeymoon destination. And it's here at the Carrington Hotel, 100 years later, that the movie reels, letters, photographs and a camera are found.
That's correct. This memorabilia is found by Emma Quinn in the modern day. So Emma is actually filming a documentary of the Carrington Hotel in the Blue Mountains. And she's waiting on a call from her wife, who's been undergoing IVF treatment. So they've gone through a number of rounds without success. And as she's filming the documentary, she's got a phone in her pocket, and at lunchtime she takes it out and she reads that once again they have been unsuccessful. And Emma is, you know, is a very sensitive creature, and she wants what her wife wants. She's passionately in love with her wife, and she wants to make her wife happy.
Let's hear from page 101. It's a beautiful piece of writing.
"Thank you. This is Emma. Then she does cry, great big sobs that I can do nothing to stop. The sound of them is difficult enough, but the feel of them shuddering through her body and into mine is the hardest to bear. I know there is nothing I can say or do to fix this. I also know we will get through it, but it will take time and love and care. I find myself wanting to project us forward to a time when the pain is less raw, a time when we have come to terms with it. But I can't. And so I just hold her, wishing for the first time in my life that I had chosen a more lucrative career."
Another quote, "Everything comes with a cost." Now, this is another connection with Rose and her company going with short of money, and also with Emma, that what would they do if they had that extra money?
So one of the things prohibiting Emma and her wife Lauren from pursuing more IVF is the cost of it. And while they acknowledge that it is getting more affordable with time, Emma and Lauren are getting older, and Emma in particular worries about the cost of it, not just financially, but also in terms of, you know, time out from careers and how long is it going to take, and, you know, what about if they want another child? So it's just very difficult for Lauren and Emma.
And Emma has this other query about just what's going on here. There's the camera has got initials written on it, EMQ. So she wants to find out about that. The description of some of the costumes, and see, this is another. Lauren is a costume designer for a theatre as well as a teacher. And the description is just intriguing, but not as detailed as the two sex scenes 100 years apart. They both involved extreme kissing. Now, Julie Bennett, was that deliberate?
I must admit that until you brought that to my attention about 15 minutes ago, I hadn't actually realised how they were both involved intense kissing. But perhaps subconsciously I did.
I think you must have.
I think I must have. But I think for me the love and sex scenes are very important, and they need to occur at particular times within the novel. So we need to build the tension up between the characters, and we need to, you know, honour that, the lovemaking in the book. And it's nice that they were both kissing, because they, I think they're beautiful characters that need excellent love scenes. So.
Excellent. Well, very well detailed.
Yes, thank you.
Well, the title, The Lost Letters of Rose Carey, now they are found, but they're still a mystery. Who are they written to and from?
Well, you might have to read the book to find out, I think. But the letters are found in a box of memorabilia relating to Rose Carey. And they, I wanted to portray with those letters the connection between the two time periods. So they serve as sort of the, you know, the connecting pieces. And Emma sort of rations herself a letter at a time, because she's going through this trauma with her wife. And she reads a letter, and through the letters we understand that something's gone desperately wrong, and the writer wants to rectify that.
I thought the resolution of this was so well formatted. It was really clever.
Thank you.
So this incredible water dancer and golden girl, you did base her on somebody.
I did. I based her on a very famous Australian called Annette Callaman. So Annette was a swimmer, she was an actress, she was a movie star, and in later life she went on to become a... She did tours around the countryside campaigning for women to get involved with exercise, not over the top, but swimming. She thought swimming was a fabulous exercise for women, and to look after their health and fitness, particularly in what they ate and what they did. So
and
she was wonderful.
Thankfully to Annette, we have now the modern version of the bathing costume.
We do.
Because she wore that first. But, oh, Rose Carey, she was the first one to go nude on the movies. Now, with this type of historical fiction, there are always interesting facts revealed. And these all were about aeroplanes.
Yeah,
the stuff
years.
I didn't know. You know, we know a lot about Australians in World War One flying for the British.
Yes.
But there was a group of Americans flying for the French.
Correct. Yes. So that was fascinating for me too. And they were quite, you know, these Americans were sort of more or less volunteers, because America wasn't in the war until later, the First World War.
Yeah.
And so they went and flew for the French. And what a wonderfully interesting cast of characters.
Oh. Yes.
Those pilots were. So if you get the opportunity to read up on them, just do. They're just amazing.
And when you picture those pilots, you see them in a boiler suit fitted at waist.
Yes.
They were called a Sidcot.
That's
invented
correct.
Invented by Australian Sydney Cotton.
Correct.
Well, I'm only reading what you've written.
Correct. I know. It's amazing, the connections, actually.
That's absolute. So movie reels, photographs, a camera and letters link two women 100 years apart in this parallel story of history and the complication of relationships in The Lost Letters of Rose Carey by Julie Bennett. Oh, Julie, well done. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Well, my author has connections with children and the Olympics as well. So there are parallels between our two authors today, but in a different sort of way. Within the title of Isabella Mead's anthology of poetry, The Infant Vine, we have the potent images of nature, new life, and a sense of vitality, all of which we're about to explore. So, Isabella, welcome to 3CR.
Thanks so much for having me.
Now, let's start then with Infant, the Infant Vine, Infant, and the genesis of this collection. What brought it about?
I've been writing poetry for a long time, but I really started in earnest probably after my first daughter, my daughter was born in February 2018. So that reference to the Olympics was around the same time as the Pyeongchang Winter Olympics. And then my son came in 2020, so a few months after the height of the Black Summer bushfires and a few weeks before Melbourne's first lockdown. So it was a very intense, strange time. Yeah, very difficult, but also very generative. So a lot of the poetry came out of that particular period of my life.
Right, and the notion of the vine, the infant vine, links us to the natural world and a sense of abundance. So I'm going to ask you to read the very first poem of the collection, The Green Wedge, if you wouldn't mind.
Sure. The Green Wedge. I am walking the river's slow edge with my daughter tucked, frog-legged, in a sun-faded carrier. Despite appearances, she is mammal to a T. She snuffles, nuzzles my chest like a truffle dog, the loamy earth. On the bank, I position her latch with my framer's hands. She drinks deeply, a memory restores. Oars muscling through water, the stroke of a welcome swallow's wing mid-flight. Birds instruct in lapsed song, mine and here and yours. My daughter pulls off, grabs my arm in her soft fist. Breath reverses in an undergrowth teeming with planet-heavy ants. There is so much we don't see. Frogs tenanting yellow marsh flowers, a glimmer of eggs cradled in the slink tympanum of pondweed. The sun softens in brown water, reeds beget reeds. Lifting my daughter to face the river, its surface corrugated with milfoil, her spring form legs kick against the heel of my heart. What will remain? Frogs or birds? The unsteady march of ants? Let it be more than loose stones bargaining at the mouth, the hatching of a lone tadpole like a clammy jolt of love.
Now what gets me here is this connection between tadpoles and children. Deliberate.
Yeah, so basically that central image came from, like, when you put a baby in a carrier, the instructions, there's lots of instructions about how to position them properly. So their heads need to be near your head, close enough to kiss, and their legs need to be in an M shape, I guess, to keep their spine aligned. So when you put a baby in that position, they do kind of look a little bit like a frog.
But you've got that exuberance and abundance of life. If anyone's ever been down to a creek and looked at tadpole spawn sort of thing, but it's all the way through loamy earth and the like, teeming with planet heavy ants. So there's this abundance there.
Yeah, that ants image came from, I think there's something about the total biomass of all the insects on Earth is greater than, you know, all the humans. So I was sort of thinking about insects. And then I'm also thinking about the climate crisis and the fact that, you know, so many species are dying off, you know, the extinction. It's,
Well, it's a frightening thing to think about, new life and extinction. Yeah. I mean, the challenges are facing young mothers in many regards there. But you've also got this lyricism, glimmer of eggs cradled in the slick tympanum of pondweed, you know, the alliteration and the like.
Yeah, that tympanum, I actually found out, I think it's, so the inside of a frog's ear is referred to the tympanum, and it's also refers to, and this might be slightly incorrect, so I'm sorry, but I think it's also like sort of cathedral, some of the ornate decorations. I'll need to double check that, but I thought that was a really interesting connection.
But the sound connects with things like timpani
and, and
the like, so that's there.
Yep.
But also then there are, well, the role of the poet, the poet's identity in making associations between things. So a baby and tadpole eggs, but we've got this is where the Olympics comes in. You've got a scheme. We won't probably read all of this, but you've got it physically presented on the page. My daughter is born in February. You take her down and to the room where it's cooler, but on the television, the Winter Olympics playing out in white and gold on television and Alpine area. And all of a sudden, we've got this sort of sense of motherhood being like a slalom race going around obstacles all the time. Is that what...
I did that purposely. So the poem, there's a small gap in the middle of each line. So they do look like those flags, so the two gates that you have to go down on the slalom. So, yeah, and then also, I guess, connecting... I think you said before, it's, you know, it's an odd association, motherhood, you know, a slalom. But, I mean, to me, like, motherhood is a very creative sort of space to be in. So you're often sort of thinking about these weird connections and associations.
But you're also negotiating obstacles all the time.
All the time, yeah, exactly.
With motherhood. But you take then this notion of a shape poem to another level with the alligator. And I'm just going to read that one out. It looks like an alligator leaping out of the water on the page. So I guess I could hold it up to the microphone for people to see. But it's probably not going to work. But here we go. The subject line of the email from my son's daycare reads, "Drone over toddler yard. Anxiety flares its little blue flames in my bloodstream as I scan the body text. A low-flying drone was reported over the toddler yard at lunchtime today. We brought the children inside. Some were frightened. Police have been notified and are investigating. In the Everglades, a gator is filmed catching, then eating a drone. I too would not hesitate to snatch those junk birds out of the warm sky, to crush their warring wings between my muscled jaws. Like an ancient dragonfly whose thatched eyes glare in every direction, the drone over toddler yard would atone for its intrusion in the dark pit of my belly, the same place where my children were brewed. Alas, my reflexes are not what they used to be. I write back, thanks, Julie, for letting me know. I want to leap, to tear something up, to put my body on the line. Instead, I return to my work. The words on screen tethered to my fingers, hovering over keys. More dragonflies. For a moment, I'm still as a reptile, half sunk in cool green water. One day, our time will come." So this notion of a mother, well, who's the predator here? This is what I want to know.
Yeah, well, it's based on a true story. Like, this did happen. A drone was found over my son's childcare centre, and got this email, and you do get that sense of, like, oh my God, and then you feel both, enraged and protective, but also impotent in the moment. So, you know, I just sent an email back saying, yeah, thanks for letting me know. I think that comes through a little bit in some of the other poems too, the rage that the mother feels in protecting their child and then ultimately not being able to fulfill their role in the moment.
But it's also the fear then of new things today to worry about, like drones and the spectre of what it's doing there and for what reason, and the emphasis we're giving to protecting children these days as well.
Yeah, as a fairly anxious person, that's always sort of coming through in my work, the idea of threat, precarity of life, how precious it is and how many things there seem to be trying to, you know, stop it or end it or change it. Yeah, I think, you know, increasing, you know, militarism in the world, the climate crisis always there. It's a lot to worry about, I guess.
Would you have children? This is a fundamental question these days, given that spectre of fear. But hasn't it always been there, perhaps? It's just the fears change?
Probably, yeah. I think that's probably the case. There's another poem in here which is called The Salience Network, and it's about, I think that refers to, like, the sense of being always on the lookout for threats. So I think that particular sort of mind frame is probably common to all parents, mothers, fathers, any caregiver.
Yeah, yeah. But also then the contrast. You've got the womb, but the anger in the pit of the belly, but also this is the place where life stems from. Anger and life in one.
And life, and also the threat of death as well. So I think, like, when, you know, you have a baby, at least in my experience, you do feel close to death as well as you're sort of birthing, you know, new life. So, yeah.
Quite profound, really. Here's another one, Remnants, Springtime. Panicles of crimped white flowers caressed, discarded by wind. Down the street we walk our infants, a flurry of light. Bright-eyed, they are taking it all in. Red car, white car, clouds nursing sky back to blue. A body crumples when it moves. We've been working the night shift, the day shift too, longest shift of our lives. Fatigue creases our smiles, seams exposed. We say, take care, we mean, give it up. Children form committees to restore wind-torn petals. We collect and salvage. Slowly, we recover. Motherhood and recovering, that's the prime role.
Yeah, and sleep deprivation comes through a lot in some of the poems, and this was very much a sort of COVID lockdown, you know, walking the streets and finding, I guess, a sense of relief through seeing my children, you know, play with nature and in nature. And yeah, it's that's probably one of my like lockdown poems for sure.
But I also like that line, clouds nursing sky back to blue.
Mm.
And just that association and the way of looking at something. Is that what a poet should do? Give us a different perspective?
I think so. I think that what makes interesting poetry and poetry that you want to read is you know, reimagining what might be an ordinary moment and, thinking about what it looks like, what it feels like. It's sort of a central role of a poet, I guess.
Another one here, we won't be able to read these out, but there's one about the mask and a mother having a mask on almost permanently.
Yeah.
So your identity is altered in some ways, or you put up a mask as a parent or a mother.
Yeah, definitely. And also quite literally, that was another, walking down to the park wearing a face mask again during that sort of 2020.
Somebody said to me about children, babies, identifying, but they couldn't because the parent was wearing a mask. Mm. And so that facial features is one of the first things babies recognise but couldn't during COVID. You've also got a sense of humour here. What to forget when you're expecting.
Yeah.
the normal perspective is, you know, what to remember and all of this sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
How much advice do you get and is it overwhelming?
You get so much advice. I mean, any kind of book preparing you for childbirth or for, you know, having a baby in the home, it's so much information. And at the end of the day, it can't really prepare you for what it's actually like. So I sort of played around with that idea and thought about, well, what should we forget? And sort of the poem ends with, you know, you should forget that our son will eventually die. And, you know, to sort of take it moment by moment, I guess.
So death and life are juxtaposed here. There's humour, there's that connection with nature, but there's also that sense of what a poet should do to re-image the world, to give us a new perspective on things. So, Isabella, thank you very much for talking with me today.
Thank you.
I can't believe we found Olympics in both books.
There you go. Connections.
And the title of Isabella's book?
The Infant Vine, collection of poetry, and it's a University of Western Australia publishing.
And I spoke with Julie Bennett about her book, The Lost Letters of Rose Carey, by Simon & Schuster.
You've just been listening to Published or Not on 3CR.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.